All right, well, we'll go ahead and slowly roll to a start here as people are trickling in. This is a fun session. Just never had one of my co-pastors and friends here before to do a session with. And so Pete's actually going to do most of this session. We're just kind of putting the skeleton to it as really something that's going on culturally, going on psychologically with people. But that's just the anxiety and the angst that is. Are you asking a question? Are you asking a question? It's my irreverent wife disturbing the session. So I wanted to just kind of frame it with some stuff that I've done recently and bringing the idea of creativity to really what's going on with all of the changes happening in the world. And so much is changing so fast that I think beneath the surface we're all struggling just to kind of make sense of it. I was just having a conversation before coming in here where somebody was talking about how do they respond to young people in Silicon Valley and this gentleman's daughter's boyfriend, and just all of what's going on culturally and the differences in conversations. Well, as I reflected on a couple years ago, that surely God has not left us without a tool or a tool set with how to deal with rapid change in society, I kind of came to this idea of it'd be fun to think of a theology of creativity. And a theology of creativity is just simply saying that if God has made us in his image, and God is creative. God has created us, male and female. He created us in his image. He created us. That hallmark verse of the image of God has one word that shows up more than any other words, and it's the word created. And so God is a creative being who creates, and we're made in his image. And that's why I said yesterday that there are no, you've never met somebody that doesn't have traces of God's creativity in them. And so when we say we don't have a creative bone in our body, what we really mean is that we're not artistic, that we don't play electric guitar, that we don't sing well, or we don't write poetry or paint. And those things are true. People can do those and do them well, and they're artistic because of it. Artistic ability is a skill or a talent that some people possess. But we are all creative. We see our own shapes in the clouds. We make our own recipes. Make our own plans for the weekend. We don't usually delegate the naming of our dogs. Sometimes we delegate the naming of our children. But we have imaginations. And so the first part of a theology of creativity is simply this, that we are creative because we're made in the image of a creative God. The second part of a theology of creativity is that creativity extends through time. God didn't just create back in the book of Genesis. And we like to talk about God as the creator, and we forget that God is a creative. That God's creativity works through time. Jesus says, my Father is always at his work, and I'm working too. God said in the book of Isaiah, don't fear the blacksmith. Basically, you have an army coming in to attack, and the Israelites are afraid of the weapons of war, and they say, God says, don't fear those people. I created the blacksmith who makes the weapons of war. In other words, I'm sovereign over this whole process. And so don't fear the banker. I'm the one who made the banker. Don't fear the doctor. I'm the one that created the doctor. I'm still actively, vitally involved in this world. And then God says in Isaiah, I will create a new heavens and a new earth. Our whole faith, the fact that we're following God is predicated on the future creativity of God. Our whole Christian life is grounded in our belief that God's going to create in the future. God is not just a creator. God is a creative that extends all the way into the future. And likewise, our creativity is a part of how we navigate life. And then lastly, a theology of creativity just comes to this idea that our creativity serves a purpose, that it's a part of how we are involved in the reconciliation of all things. It's a part of our ministry of how we redeem and work towards reconciliation and restoration in life. Jesus takes the temple that was meant to be the space where we could come close to God, and he says, you tear this temple made by human hands down, and I will build it again in 3 days. My death and my resurrection is going to create a new space where you can come into contact or come close or be drawn close to God. And so away goes the old space for being close to God, and Jesus is making a new space where we can be reconciled. When we are creative in our parenting, when we're creative in our conflict management that we do when we're trying to make peace with different people, when we're creative at work, when we're creative in starting nonprofits, when we're creative in the ministries that we're involved in at church, what we're really doing is using our God-given creativity along the purposes that he laid out whereby we can glorify him. Basically, by making space whereby people can flourish, the good, the true, the beautiful, to know God, to know each other in the right kinds of relationship, to experience love and safety. And so our creativity, the kind of final part here, is that our creativity is at the service of our calling to be a part of the reconciliation of all things. So we create because God made us creative and we're made in his image. We create through time as God does, and ultimately our creativity is at the service of our calling to be agents of reconciliation in this world. So in an age of anxiety, one of the things that we have is this opportunity to dream, to imagine, to create, to believe that there are possibilities out there that we haven't yet realized because things are not fixed or static. They're open. Because we have a creative God. So that's kind of a way of coming at it that I wrote into a small book called Create Versus Copy that's in the bookstore, just a little 100-page book, really working out an idea of creativity and then kind of bringing in some of the science and psychology around human creativity and imagination and trying to give some practical things to that on how people can engage that way. But what I thought would be fun, because I don't know that I've ever heard it happen at Mount Hermon, would be to tee up Pete, who does Enneagram consulting and takes people through this this tool for spiritual growth and understanding ourselves in anxiety or anxious states and how we can kind of from a spiritual formation standpoint kind of lean into this. So I'll let Pete explain that to you guys, and I'm going to come join you all because I've never actually gotten to sit through the full presentation. So ladies and gentlemen, Pete Kelly.
Thank you. Good morning. Good to see you guys. Thanks for coming. How many of you are somewhat familiar with the Enneagram? Heard it before? All right. If you haven't, it probably looks like it should have a goat head in the middle or something like that. Looks a little sketchy. But what I want to roll out is just basically a really introductory overview of this tool. It's an ancient personality typing system, so it's we all know about personality tests, Myers-Briggs and StrengthsFinders and things like that, which are all great. Enneagram isn't primarily a personality test, but it's a typing system that helps us identify the unique way that we tend to see the world. And as a tool for spiritual formation, it's one of the most helpful things I've ever come across as a pastor who's walking with lots of people, like Ken was talking about, navigating anxiety, both in the circumstances in the world that we encounter, as well as the anxiety within us. And this is one of the most useful tools I've come across that helps navigate that stuff at a deep level, not just bandaging over some of the things that we're feeling, but actually paying close attention to our hearts and understanding that not everybody sees the world the way that we do. And so it's a really, really helpful tool that I just wanted to give an intro to. Now, typically, this will be a 4 to 6 week class that consumes many hours and is a long process. But this morning, the idea is just to present it to you and then let you take it from there if it's something that grabs your heart. And so here's where we'll start. In Matthew 7, part of the Sermon on the Mount that we've been looking at this week, Jesus famously says, "Why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye and pay no attention to the plank in your own eye? How can you say to your brother, let me take the speck out of your eye, when all the time there's a plank in your own eye? You hypocrite, first take the plank out of your own eye, then you will see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye. Now, a passage we all know very well, but the thing I want to call your attention to is that apparently, for Jesus, it's incredibly important that his followers are growing in this practice of what you might call self-awareness, that we are paying attention to our own lives and not just monitoring and trying to modify our behavior, but actually really being attentive to what's happening beneath the surface, what you might call the sin beneath our sins, or our motives or affections that drive our attitudes and decisions and relationships, both with God and with ourselves and with others around the world. And so Jesus gives this very clear directive to his disciples, to this kingdom community that he's addressing, and saying, one of the marks of my people must be that they're people who are paying close attention to their own lives. Now, the point isn't just to get to some place of enlightenment or utopia or something like that. The point is that as we are doing this work of self-discovery and growing in self-awareness, that is what will actually enable us to love and to serve the world in the name of Christ, right? So first, as we remove these planks, whatever they may be, from our own eyes, then we'll be able to see clearly to remove the speck from others. And so in order for us to actually become the kind of people that Jesus calls us to be, which I would argue is the kind of people the world needs most, part of that journey is for us to learn how to pay attention to our own lives, to our own hearts, to our own motives and worldviews, and our preferred way of dealing with the feelings of anxiety and vulnerability that we encounter on a regular basis. And so this isn't just self-help, but this is actually part of the formation or discipleship process that Jesus calls us into. So another familiar passage along the same lines in 1 Timothy, watch your life and doctrine closely. Persevere in them, because if you do, you will save both yourself and your hearers. So we titled this seminar just really simply Spiritual Leadership. And the idea is that if we are going to be people who are spiritually leading others, whether that's as pastors or leaders within the church, or simply within our home as parents or within our friendships in community, to be someone who can lead others spiritually first requires that we're able to lead ourselves. Right? So self-leadership is a huge part of this journey towards spiritual leadership. And so in the Matthew passage as well as here in Timothy, the instruction is to pay close attention, to watch your life and doctrine closely, to spend some time to create rhythms, to collect tools and pathways that will actually help you see the truth about yourself. Okay? So there's this tool called the Johari Window that's been around for many years now in psychology and sociology circles. But I think there's an application in terms of our discipleship and formation as well. And it has to do with the idea that every single person has four parts of ourself. And there's the open, the blind, the hidden, and the unknown. And so we all have open parts of ourselves, that which is known to ourselves and that which is known to others. The thing that kind of is obvious to us about who we are and what we're like, and the things that people around us would recognize as well. We also have hidden parts to move down, the things that we know about ourselves to be true, but others don't, that we've chosen not to disclose those parts of our person to others. We all have hidden areas. And then we have these things called blind spots, the top corner, the things that others know about us, but that we don't know about ourselves. Things that for whatever reason we don't recognize as being true about the way we operate or our motives, that the people who are observing us and relating to us regularly are aware of. And then finally, there's the unknown, right? These things that are not known to ourselves or to our others, or to others. And so, like I said, everybody has all four parts of this window reflected in their life. And they're not necessarily proportionate, as in nice little rectangles, but we all have these spaces. And And so out of the Johari window, there are these three secrets. The reality that there is something about yourself that you don't tell others. We all have these places. There's something about yourself that others don't tell you. And ultimately, what we're trying to get at this morning, and really all week, is that there's something about yourself that God wants you to know. And what I would argue is that transformation occurs when the unknown becomes known. So when we talk about being spiritually formed or discipled by the Spirit to grow into people who bear the image and likeness of Christ, when we talk about our formation into Jesus, there are going to be these moments and seasons of transformation along the way. That Jesus invites us to follow him, which means we are going to need to be willing to leave where we are, to go where he's going, and to learn what he wants to teach us. And so transformation occurs when that which is unknown becomes known. And so in all three of these secrets, these three secrets that control each of our lives, there's opportunities for transformation to occur within ourselves and the relationship we have with our own selves, within our relationships with one another, within family and friendship and community, as well as ultimately in our relationship with God. That there's always going to be something that he sees and knows to be true about us that we haven't yet seen or learned to be true. And so the Enneagram is one of the ways or one of the tools that I like to use to help people begin this journey of transformation. And so again, it's this kind of weird-looking shape, but it basically just literally, Ennea is 9, right? And gram is a drawing or a picture. So the word Enneagram just means a 9-sided or 9-pointed drawing. I'll start with this definition, that it's a tool that assists in self-discovery. It's a personality typing system that suggests there are 9 different personality styles in the world, one of which we naturally gravitate toward and adopt in childhood to cope and to feel safe. Each type or number has a distinct way of seeing the world and an underlying motivation that powerfully influences how that type thinks, feels, and behaves. Okay, so that's what we're talking about. Again, not primarily a personality test, but a system which helps us understand that we all primarily gravitate towards one of these 9 ways of seeing ourselves within the world. And so here's the truth about using a tool like the Enneagram in the way that we're talking about, is that it's actually not that much fun, right? Some of you geek out on personality tests and love Strengths Finders and INFPJT, and all that kind of stuff. And those are great tools, which can be really helpful. Enneagram is a little bit different than that in that it is dynamic, in that it doesn't just say, here's who you are, this is your number, and therefore this is what you're good at or this is what you're going to be like. But it actually helps you identify, one way of saying it is, what is the name of that plank in your eye? And what is my natural way of trying to deal with that sense of anxiety or those feelings of I need to be safe or I need to find security? So another way of putting it is that your Enneagram number is your preferred way of avoiding God. Or you might say it's the fig leaf that you've chosen. It's your default way of trying to look within yourself for what only can be found in Christ. Okay? So all that to say, it's not that much fun unless you're really committed to this journey of transformation. And so Richard Rohr is one of the great Christian thinkers and teachers on the Enneagram, and he says the Enneagram number you find is not for the sake of mere self-categorization. It is for the enlightenment of the person by helping them to recognize their own addictive pattern of seeing and thinking. Okay, so this is where the painful process begins, is understanding that not only is this number that describes my personality something that kind of characterizes the way I relate to myself and God and others, but it's actually an addiction. And for those that have any familiarity with the world of addiction and recovery, that language begins to take on some weight. This is something that is so deep within me that it's like I can't even stop even if I wanted to. Right? And so, three cautions before we get into it, and then I want to kind of give you an overview of the nine types. And maybe you're already kind of objecting to some of what you're hearing. The first caution is that none of these types are better or worse than any of the others. And the world needs all nine types of personalities. And so I want to avoid any sense of feeling like, oh, I wish I was a seven, but I'm only a one or something like that. Now, I do wish I was a seven, but I understand that the world needs all nine types. And so I just want to encourage you as we enter this journey, and especially as you move on from here, for those of you that kind of catch a vision for this, come at this with a sense of humor and a sense of self-graciousness and understanding that, yeah, there may be some painful things that this exposes and maybe even a little bit embarrassing or humiliating, but that doesn't mean that there's something fundamentally flawed with who you are or what your number is. Secondly, humans are complex beings, like Ken said, made in God's image and likeness, and therefore our identity can't be reduced to a number. Okay, this number is not the ultimate truth about you. So again, I don't hold this up as like the way or anything like that. It's obviously just a tool that can be helpful. And humans are complex, right? We have many layers to our life, to our soul, to our story. And so reduce the temptation to go around typing yourself or others like, oh, you're being such a seven, or I'm just being such a one, or something like that, right? We're more than a number. And thirdly, leading into that, is to guard against categorizing or labeling people according to their type. And so it is just like with any of these kind of personality systems, it's easy not only to categorize, but maybe even to have the tendency to exploit or to hurt or try to manipulate people once you know something about their personality. And the Enneagram should never be used in a way that that mocks or attacks or tears down another person. It really can only be used in a healthy way when it's used to help and to serve and to love people well. And so, those are my three cautions before we dive in. You're not just a number, but it is an incredibly helpful tool. And so the process of discovering your number on the Enneagram is, there's a lot of different ways to go about it. The best way is to read through a good description of all nine types. And so instead of starting with a test, I recommend that you find a good description. I'll recommend a couple books at the end that will give you a good start. But read through all the descriptions. And secondly, what you're looking for is to identify the description that makes you feel most exposed or embarrassed. Okay, that's how we know when we're actually starting to get close, is when you feel like somebody knows something about you that they shouldn't. And it feels a little bit, you start feeling self-conscious, like you've been exposed. That's a good sign. And as you read through the descriptions and as we walk through them in a few moments, that's what I want you to pay attention to, is which one feels vulnerable. And then finally, there are lots of tests online that you can take. A free one is at transformind.com. And it takes about 10 minutes. You can run through it, and it'll at least give you maybe your top two or three numbers to think about. If that's not conclusive and you're starting to find yourself wanting to go deeper in, there's full-on, like, hour-long tests that you can take. Many of them cost 10 or 15 bucks. But really, once you read through the descriptions, you should at least have a top two or three that you can narrow it down to. So that's where I start, is try to get familiar with all of them and then narrow it down from there. So why don't we run through the nine types? I want to just kind of give you a brief overview. And again, listen and pay attention to each one and look for those feelings of this is a little bit awkward and feels like Pete knows something about me that he shouldn't or something like that. So type one is the reformer, also known as the perfectionist. And this is the need to be perfect. Okay, so in Richard Rohr's language, he defines each one by that need and saying this is the thing that we look to find what only Jesus can give us. And so the way that a one would deal with the sense of anxiety, insecurity, vulnerability, their default addiction is to to move towards perfection. And so the four words for the one would be idealist, principled, independent, and critical. Basic fear of the one is of being corrupt or evil or defective. And the basic desire of the one is to be good, to have integrity, and to be balanced. Next slide, what it's like to be a one. People have told me, see if you can relate to any of these statements. People have told me I can be overly critical and judgmental. I'm sometimes called a perfectionist. Secondly, I beat myself up when I make mistakes. I don't feel comfortable when I try to relax. There's too much to be done. I don't like it when people ignore me, or ignore or break the rules, and details are important to me. Okay? So ones tend to be very black and white in their thinking and in their operating. They tend to have a very strong sense of right and wrong, and it bothers them deeply when things aren't as good as they should be, or people aren't as good as they should be. And so ones don't mean to be critical, but when they walk into a room, the first thing they're thinking is, how could this be better, right? How could the decor, how could the music, how could the teaching, how could the relationships be better? And they mean to be helpful in that process of making things more perfect, but oftentimes that comes across as criticism. But they're not just critical of their environment and of others, but they're incredibly critical of themselves and have very high standards and even a vision of their perfect self that they're constantly trying to attain to. And so it's almost, the ones that I know talk about it, almost like you're hearing voices. Voices that are telling you that you should be doing better, that you are not living up to your own standards or expectations. And so it's a difficult place to be. So that's a picture of a one. Should I do the videos? No? I'll give you a video just to break this up a little bit. These are caricatures, but they are kind of helpful. They're about a minute long each. They're super lo-fi YouTube downloads. But maybe it'll help you get the picture a little bit better. And so this is what it's like to be a one.
Hey, what's new? Well, I found a better way to get here this morning. Really? Yes, I used Google Maps. Oh, I just used the paper map. I know. I found a better way. I was also thinking you would look better in a blue shirt. Oh, I like red. I know. Blue would bring out your eyes. Well, I better get going. Have a nice day.
Okay. So that's our one. The need to be perfect. The reformer, the perfectionist. I'm going to ask, how many feel like maybe that might be me? All right. Got some maybe ones. That's what, you can raise your hand multiple times if you're not sure yet, but we'll at least get a feel. Okay, that's our type one. Move on. Type two is the helper. This is the need to be needed. Four words would be relational, generous, people-pleasing, and possessive. The basic fear of the two is being unwanted or unworthy of being loved. And the basic desire of the two is to feel loved. Here's what it's like to be two. When it comes to taking care of others, I don't know how or when to say no. Lots of people ask me for help, and it makes me valuable. I feel drawn to influential or powerful people. When I feel tired, I often feel like people take me for granted, and I'm more comfortable giving than receiving. Okay, so twos tend to be very nurturing, very servant-hearted, very eager to help and happy to do whatever needs to be done. My friends that are twos, when they come over to our house for dinner, they're doing the dishes, right? And they're cleaning up afterward. And they're uncomfortable being on the receiving end of generosity. But the shadow side of the two is that they secretly have this sense of pride. That I am doing so much for others, I'm helping, I'm giving myself away constantly, and therefore there's a little bit of a sense of pride that goes with that, as well as even a sense of entitlement that we would rarely ever verbalize, but we feel like I've done so much for others, therefore I feel like I'm owed some recognition or love or sense of belonging in return. And so it's a little bit of a tormented place to feel like, and especially a hard realization for people that are new to this, to realize that your serving and giving and loving of others may not be entirely selfless, but there may actually be a self-serving or prideful motive behind it. And that's a difficult plank to acknowledge in your own eye. So let's meet our two.
Hey, what's new?
Not much. You look like you need me to help you. Can I get something for you? Or do you need me to do anything?
Well, not really.
I don't mind doing things for you. I'm never too busy.
Okay, but I think I'm just fine.
Really, it's no trouble. Do you need to borrow my sunglasses?
No, I don't think so. Really, I'm doing just fine.
Well, if you change your mind, just let me know. I will be right here.
Okay, I'll be sure to let you know.
Okay, I'll be waiting. I'm right here. Just in case.
I love how each one ends with an awkward silence. All right, so that's our two, the helper, the need to be needed. How many of you think you might have some two in you? Okay, good. Interesting. All right, let's move on. Next number. Type three is the achiever. This is the need to succeed. Four words would be adaptable, excelling, driven, or image conscious. The basic fear of the three is being worthless, and the basic desire is to feel valuable and worthwhile. What it's like to be a three? It's important for me to come across as successful or as a winner. I avoid failure. I love walking in a room and knowing I'm making a great first impression. I can be very persuasive. The keys to my happiness are efficiency, productivity, and being acknowledged as the best. I don't like it when people slow me down. I've been told at times I can be a workaholic. Okay, so threes, the achiever. In some ways, it's the stereotypical American dream kind of person, right? That's going to work hard to make it in life and feel really good about themselves when they've accomplished the things that they've set their mind to. And for three, there's this shadow side that tends to be a chameleon-like characteristic. So it's so important for me to win or to succeed in any environment I'm in that I have this ability to lose my sense of self in order to adapt to what it takes to win in that room. So therefore, threes are good in social settings where they can walk in, read a room, and figure out, what do I need to do or become to win here? Like a chameleon. But obviously the downside is that you end up having a very evasive sense of self. If you're constantly trying to adapt to your environment, you're having a really hard time figuring out who am I actually, and what's the thing that's most true about me. And so threes are hard workers. All they do is win, and they're terrified of mediocrity, but tend to be those that are constantly achieving and striving and are very, very image conscious. It's important to them to have the look of success. And not necessarily in huge houses and fancy cars, but within whatever field or environment they're in, that I'm winning in this endeavor. So let's meet our three.
Hey, what's new? I just got promoted. That's great. Yeah, it is. Did you get a promotion? No. You're not too ambitious, I guess. Don't these sunglasses look good on me? They are really expensive. I'm sure. You could really use some. I'm okay. Well, you would look a little better. Don't worry though. You look fine. I gotta go. I am having dinner with Madonna. See you later.
How many think you may have some three in you? Winners. Good. All right. Move kind of quickly here. Type 4, the individualist, also known as the romantic. This is the need to be special. This is those who walked into the room today and said, I don't like these personality tests because I don't want to be put in a box. You are in a box. That box is called type 4, and I'm not putting you in it. the 4 words to describe the 4 are dramatic, artistic, melancholic, and intuitive. The basic fear of the 4 is that they have no identity or personal significance, and the basic desire of the 4 is to find themselves in their significance or to create an identity. So what it's like to be a 4, I like things that are unconventional, dramatic, and refined. I'm not a fan of the ordinary. I'm often referred to as a romantic. I never really felt like I belonged. I had so many feelings in a day that it's hard to know which ones to pay attention to first. Some people think I'm aloof, but really I'm just unique. And in social situations, I tend to hang back and wait for others to approach me. So 4s tend to be very creative, very deep feelers that are constantly trying to manage all the different emotions that they're experiencing, and therefore feel like there's nobody else gets me, that there's nobody else like me, that I'm a unique snowflake, and I'm always kind of uncomfortable in my own skin. And as depressing as that sounds, a 4 tends to actually enjoy that. They secretly enjoy being depressed and feeling like there's no one else like me, that I'm unique. And I'm really special. And obviously then the challenge for the 4 is to the tendency to get lost in this sea of emotions and to be almost paralyzed by, I'm feeling so many different things and I don't know what to do with all of it and I don't know how to express it. And I feel like I can't really be in relationship with people because they don't really understand me and what I'm thinking and what I'm going through. And so 4s tend to be great artists, right? All that emotion out in great songs or paintings or movies or whatever it is, but also kind of tormented internally as well. So let's meet our 4.
Hey, what's new? I thought you would never ask. I feel like this is all a waste of time. Oh. You seem like you want to talk about your feelings too. No, I feel okay. Oh well, I tried, I guess. You can talk more about your feelings if you want to. Talking about feelings is important. That's what you keep telling me. I am glad that I am the most special person in your life. And I really like your shirt.
Man. How many of you think you might be a 4? Only one, which feels pretty good, right? Good. Awesome. All right, the 5 is the investigator, the need to perceive. And basic words are perceptive, innovative, secretive, and isolated. The basic fear is being useless, helpless, or incapable, and the basic desire is to be capable and competent. What it's like to be a 5, I can take care of myself, and I think others could do the same. I don't always say things out loud, but in my head, I'm pretty sarcastic and cynical. 3, I always feel awkward around other people. I often feel awkward. 4, I'm okay if people ask me a few specific questions about myself. But I don't like it when people want too much information. And I need time alone and have to be very careful with my time and energy. Okay, so 5s tend to be specialists. They tend to have something that is their thing, or several areas like that where they like to know everything there is to know about that thing. They like to be an investigator or an expert on something. 5s often tend to be collectors for whatever reason. They have collections of whatever it may be. In my perception, 5s often communicate using movie quotes quite frequently. They find things that they can latch onto that help them express what they're saying. And so 5s are usually very, very intelligent people that have a great deal of knowledge and understanding in certain things. And their shadow side is that they tend to be a little bit stingy with that knowledge or with that expertise. They kind of take some pride in the fact that they know or command something better than others do. And so there's a little bit of a greediness that tends to come along with the type five. So let's meet our five.
Hey, what's new? Are you talking to me? Yeah, how are you? From what perspective? Well, from yours, I guess. That is a very broad question that can relate to many aspects of the individual. I will need to look into this question further. I am going to be going now. So soon? This may not be soon enough.
How many of you think you might have some five in you? Anybody? Couple. All right. Good. Moving on. Type six is the loyalist, the need for security. So four words would be engaging, responsible, anxious, and suspicious. Basic fear of the six is being without support or guidance. And the basic desire of the six is to have security and support. What it's like to be a six, I'm always imagining and planning for the worst. I often don't trust people who are in authority. People say I'm loyal, understanding, funny, and compassionate. Most of my friends don't have as much anxiety as I do, and I act quickly in a crisis. But when things settle down, I fall apart. And so sixes have this need for comfort, or not so much comfort as security and a sense of safety, that everything's going to be okay. And so many of the sixes I know would say that they suffer from PTSD, pre-traumatic stress disorder, right? That even if things haven't gone wrong yet, I'm in a state of worry about everything that could go wrong, and therefore I'm constantly latching on to whatever authority figures or systems or structures might be incredibly helpful. And so if you listen to conservative talk radio at all and pay attention to the ads that play between the talk shows, you'll notice that they're largely catering to an audience of sixes. Because what are they selling? Survival tools, gun safes, right? Home security systems, protection for your software so you don't get hacked, so you don't get your identity stolen. And so they largely have identified a six in their audience and are saying this is what's going to sell, is this sense of security. So that's what it's like to be a six. Let's meet our six.
Hey, what's new? Oh, you scared me. Sorry. I didn't mean to frighten you. I am not feeling safe here. Is there a rope anywhere? Have you seen any snakes? No. Did you just frown at me? I don't think so. I have a headache. I'm worried it could be a tumor. Oh. You should get your eyes checked. You could have a thyroid problem. I am going to the doctor again. He tells me what to do. Nice talking to you. Have a great day.
Anybody might be a six? A few sixes? Yeah, good. Probably the most common number, actually, but a little bit hard to nail down since it is so common. It's kind of just recognized as being somewhat normal. Six is a complex number as well. There's several different ways to be a six that look radically different from each other. So you can explore that a little bit more if you're interested. All right, moving on. Type seven, the enthusiast, the need to avoid pain. So enthusiast is spontaneous, versatile, scattered, and entertaining. Their basic fear is being deprived and in pain, and their basic desire is to be satisfied and content. Here's what it's like to be a seven. I'm always the first person up for a last-minute adventure. When things get too serious for too long, I usually find a way to get people to lighten up, often by telling jokes and funny stories. I don't like making hard and fast commitments to things. I suffer from FOMO, the fear of missing out. Anticipation is the best part of life. Sometimes I get so eager for the future, I can hardly wait for it to get here. Guys, so sevens, the enthusiasts, tend to be very fun. They like to laugh. They like adventure. They like new experiences. They like to have a good time and avoid boring, dull, hard moments in life. They really enjoy Easter and not Good Friday kind of people. And so so sevens are fun to be around, life of the party kind of people, are always looking forward to the next thing and planning out the next great adventure or trip or something new or something like that. And obviously the shadow side of that is this kind of need to avoid pain, this need to constantly stay at a high and just find the enjoyable parts of life and try to skip over the rest. And we know that it's in those times of loss and pain and suffering and grief that God tends to do his best work in us. And so the journey for the seven is learning how to, yeah, continue to enjoy life and laugh out loud and have a lot of fun, but also to be willing to enter into the dark and painful parts of their own lives, as well as in the world around them and the people around them. So let's meet our fun seven.
Hi, what's new?
Oh, so many things. I am so excited.
Oh, I just had to bury my dog.
That's too bad. Today I am going to the store, and then I am going to get some new pants. Then, I am meeting a friend for lunch and I think I will buy a new house.
Wow, that sounds exhausting.
Well, you need to be more happy about things.
I did just bury my dog.
Well, that's okay. Just to get a new dog. And keep smiling.
So my wife Jen is a seven, a healthy, integrated seven. Her mom is as well. And when we first watched this little clip, it just killed us because we had had almost this same experience with Jen's mom, my mother-in-law. My grandma was on her deathbed about a year ago, and our whole family was gathered around to say goodbye to my grandma, and we were staying with Jen's parents. So at the end of kind of a hard, long day of goodbye, we went back to my in-law's place, and Jen's mom said, "How's everybody doing?" And I said, "Oh, we're all pretty sad." And she said, "Well, we're not sad. We just sold our house." And they poured a nice glass of wine, and everybody had a good time. And it's either the last person that you want to be with during a hard time or the first person, right? Because they actually called us out of that grief, and we're able to recognize some beauty and goodness in life too. So it's not all bad, right? But there's obviously a balance or a journey that needs to be attained there. So how many think you might have some seven in you? Okay, a few of you. All right, two more. The eight is the commander, the need to be against. The commander is self-confident, decisive, willful, confrontational. The basic fear is being harmed or controlled by others, and their basic desire is to protect themselves. What it's like to be an eight, I've been told that I'm too blunt and aggressive. Doing things halfway is not my thing. I enjoy a good verbal skirmish just to see what others are made of. In relationships that matter to me, I insist on being honest about conflicts and staying in the fight till things are worked out. And five, it's hard for me to trust people. And so eights tend to be the boss, right? The commander or the controller, somebody who likes to be in charge, or just kind of the classic strong leader that has a sense of where they're going and invites other people to be along. But oftentimes people end up feeling steamrolled by the eight, and not valued, used instead of loved, or something like that. And so the journey for the eight is to continue to learn how to be a good and a strong thinker and leader, but also to understand that that not everybody sees the world the way that they do. And so, for example, Ken is an eight, and a healthy and integrated eight. We were just talking about this camping trip that's coming up that both of our families had the opportunity to go on, and neither of us want to go on the trip. The reason he said he doesn't want to go is because once he got there, he'd feel trapped. He'd feel like he had to stay there and wasn't free to leave, right? I'm a 9, which we'll get to in the moment. The reason I didn't want to go is because the camping trip sounded too hard, right? So we both had different reasons for not wanting to go. I would never cross my mind to feel like I was losing control. I'm too lazy. And so, 8s are blunt, aggressive, and strong leaders. Let's meet our 8.
Hey, what's new? I'll tell you what's new. You seem incompetent. I'm just standing here. I know. That is why I am going to have to do everything myself. If you say so. Oh, I do say so. That seems very direct. Does that bother you? A little, yes. Too bad.
Oh. How many of you feel like you might have some 8 in you? All right, good. And then finally, we'll move on. Final one, the peacemaker, the need to avoid. So the 7 is the need to avoid pain. The 9 is the need to avoid everything else. Right? So 4 words would be receptive, reassuring, agreeable, or complacent. Our basic fear is loss and separation. And the basic desire is to have inner stability or peace of mind. Here's what it's like to be a 9. I'll do almost anything to avoid conflict. I tend to see 2 sides to everything. Sometimes I get lost in doing trivial tasks while things that really need to get done get put off. I'm happy to go along with what others want to do, and people seem to want me to be more decisive. Okay? So I happen to be a 9, a peacemaker, and well aware at this point in the journey of this need to avoid. The need to avoid especially confrontation, hard conversations, or hard decisions. I end up being a very chronic procrastinator just because I'll always put off the hard thing that needs to be done. And really my life mantra is I'd rather not. Whatever it is that we're talking about, I'm good. You guys go ahead without me. I'd rather not. So why would you stand if you could sit down? Why would you sit down if you could lie down? I'm pretty content just being an inanimate object and rather not impose my presence on the world. So the journey is, for a 9, coming to believe that our presence actually does matter, that our voice matters, that what I think and what I feel really matters, and learning to have a sense of self in the first place is a hard journey for a 9. So the first thing I became self-aware of was my lack of self-awareness as a 9. If you ask me how I'm doing, I don't know. I haven't thought about it. And if I took some time, maybe I could give you an answer. But in general, I have no idea. I'm just here. So how are you? Let's meet our 9.
Hey. What's new?
What is new with you?
I was going to get something to eat. Would you like to join me?
Sure.
What would you like?
Whatever. I will eat anything.
Okay. How about Mexican?
That sounds good.
Or Italian?
That sounds good.
Or Chinese?
That sounds good.
Okay. It's your choice.
You seem indecisive. Maybe we can invite some other people and see what they would like. Or we can just get Mexican, or Italian, or Chinese. It's up to you.
So yeah, 9s tend to be very indecisive, wanting to just keep the peace. I want to live at peace with myself, with relationships, with other environments. And so therefore, what I will do is, in conversation, even if I disagree with what you're saying, I'll smile and nod, because what's important to me is that our relationship is intact. What you're receiving, though, is that, oh, Pete agrees with me and we're on the same page, and when it becomes clear that I'm not, you feel like I've lied to you or haven't been honest with you, right? And so my attempt to move towards healthy relationship actually does the opposite. Right. So those are, oh, how many 9s? Other 9s? Okay, Yeah, it's hard to get your hand that high up. and walking up all these hills and all this kind of stuff. Camp is hard. But so those are the nine types. I hope you got at least a little glimpse of where you might be. And again, this is a really long process. But let me just give you one last thing in terms of a step forward. Because again, this isn't just like a strengths finder or whatever that says this is what you are and this is what you'll always be. This is an invitation towards transformation. That these things that are our functional or default ways of avoiding God can actually find their place. And so whatever your number is, it's not all bad. There is something good and pure that God has gifted you with, right? So if you're a commander or an individualist or a servant or a peacemaker, the world needs all nine types. Peacemakers are especially blessed, right? If we're actually using that gift as it's meant to be used, instead of elevating that gift to the place of God. Right? Do you get that? And so, yes, be a commander, be an achiever, be a perfectionist in a healthy way that's saying, this is the personality God's given me, and in the right integrated environment and construct, it's a gift to the world, and it's a beautiful act of worship and a reflection of what God's like. But when that thing becomes an addiction or a controlling force in our life that's stronger than the promptings of the Spirit or the teachings of Jesus, then it's become out of balance and we're in a bad place. And so in Ephesians 4, Paul uses the language of putting on and putting off to talk about the old and the new self. So he says, you were taught with regard to your former way of life to put off your old self, which is being corrupted by its deceitful desires, to be made new in the attitude of your minds, and to put on the new self, created to be like God in true righteousness and holiness. And so for each number on the Enneagram, there's something that we are invited to put off, to recognize that tendency in our life and to push back on it, and in its place to take on another characteristic that looks more like the person Jesus is inviting us to be. And so for each number, it could be laid out something like this, that for the one, you're invited to take off anger and to put on patience. For the two, put off pride and put on humility. For the three, put off deceit and put on honesty. For the four, put off envy and put on contentment. For the five, put off greed and put on generosity. For the six, put off fear and put on courage. For the seven, put off gluttony and put on true joy. For the eight, put off lust and put on innocence. And for the nine, put off indolence or laziness and put on right action. Okay. So as a very first step in using this tool for spiritual formation, it's pay attention to those things in the put-off category. Even in your daily life, what is the thing that causes me or exposes the anger or the greed or the gluttony or the lust for more? And can I name that and instead make a choice to put on this virtue on the other side? So if you want to know more, the two best books I recommend are Richard Rohr, Enneagram from a Christian Perspective, and the newer one, Road Back to You by Ian Crone and Suzanne Stabile. Enneagram from Christian Perspective is about 20, 25 years old now and kind of the first book that I know of that engages Enneagram from Christian angle. And Road Back to You is brand new, first book published by a major evangelical publisher on the topic, and there's many more to come. And so obviously there's a million resources online as well. If you want to find out a little bit more, just Google Enneagram Type 3 or Type 1 or Type 2, and you'll find millions of pages that will help you learn a little bit more on the journey. So that's the Enneagram. Do we have time for a little Q&A? Or if you need to go grab your kids or you're ready to roll, then go ahead. But I'd be happy to field a couple questions if you want. Yeah. Good. Yeah, so you have one primary number. And eventually you'll kind of narrow it down and figure out that this is my number. But you also have what's called a wing number. And so your wing number is your adjacent number on either side. And so I'm a 9 with a 1 wing. So that wing kind of flavors my 9-ness. So I'm a peacemaker that also has a perfectionist kind of bent to me. So everybody has one number, and then you may have one or even 2 wings. You may have a wing on either side. So, correct. Yep. Since I'm a 9, it would be an adjacent number on either side. So either 8 or 1. Yep. So as you take your test, pay attention. If you score really high on 3, for example, then look between 2 and 4 and see which one you score higher on. That most likely is going to be your wing number. Yeah. I mean, it takes people a long time sometimes to figure out their number. And sometimes you have to think about in different environments. You may take on different characteristics. So at home, I'm more like this, but at work, I have to be like this. And so what I would say is try to go back to childhood and answer the questions or think about the system through the lens of how I've actually behaved most of my life. So maybe you like to think of yourself as somebody who does new things, but do you actually? Right? So how have I actually behaved? Yeah. Another question? They do. And we didn't even get into it today, but that's one of the best things about the Enneagram is that it's dynamic in nature. And so there's really this whole movement that the numbers that are connected to one another kind of informs the language of where you would go in stress or security. And so, for example, as a 9, when I am stressed or in an unhealthy place, I start to take on the negative characteristics of a 6. Okay? But when I'm in a healthy place or a secure place, I take on the healthy characteristics of a 3. And so there's always this kind of sense of movement. And so that's why for a 9, to put off laziness and to put on right action is to be more of an achiever. Right, more of a go-getter to get up and do something instead of rather not. So there's arrows that you can find that will kind of help you understand which way you go in stress and security. But that's why this is beautiful. Is when I'm actually functioning in a healthy way, you wouldn't recognize me for what my real number is. You'd mistake me for what my secure number is. So, questions? Yeah. You know, there's seasons where you're required to adapt and take on another number. So most moms I know feel like 2s, right? They feel like helpers, they feel like nurturers, because that's the role that they're in. And then when life changes and the kids are out of the house, then they kind of realize, oh, maybe I'm not a 2. And so I don't think it's actually that your number changes, I just think that the requirements and the things that are drawn out of you can change over time. Your number will always be your number, for better or worse. Yeah. There are. People do a lot of overlaps and figure out your Myers-Briggs. If you're this type on Myers-Briggs, you're more likely to be a 6 or to be a 4 or something like that. So you can find long lists of that stuff online. Well, thanks for being here, guys. Appreciate it. Have fun.